How you doing, Roger?
Hi, Mitch. How are you?
Nice to have you on. I know you're involved with this program, Witchblade.
Yeah, I just did an episode for them, and it's good fun.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about this. This thing's getting a whole lot of attention. How did they come to? How did they come to you? I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way, but you know, there are a lot of actors out there. There are a lot of ways they could have gone. You know, did you express interest? Did you know some of the people involved?
No, it just happened, and I'm a jobbing actor, and it was a job that I got, and was happy to do it, and it was a good fun to do. And if you like the genre, it's a good piece of work.
Yeah, it's sort of a combination of a cop show and kind of science fiction-y, isn't it?
Very. Yeah. Very. There's no kind of dimension in time.
And what does Roger Daltrey play in this episode?
I play a Catholic priest.
Oh, so it really is acting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at least we know you have range, you know, so you can stretch out. Now, I know you've been in a number of movies and things like that, but is acting taking up more of your time than singing these days?
No, it's what I do when who aren't working. I mean, I don't sit on my butt. Waiting for them to work. I just
Witchblade, by the way, is on TNT on Tuesday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern time, and this particular episode airs July 10th. When you say I don't wait for them to go out working, I mean it's not a them thing, Roger. When you talk about the who, isn't it a we thing?
Well, it is them. I call it as though it's a, you know, it's as though the who is in another room.
Oh yeah. So we got the who and the them. We got every pronoun involved. Well, who makes the actual decisions, you know, when you're going to go out, when you're going to do any...
Well, basically, it's Pete, because he's got a much more complicated family life than any of the other the rest of us, so it's dependent on him.
Well, but you're the actor. You're the one who has to say, I have my roles That's to right. consider. I have to do Witchblade.
Yeah,
I may not be able to do
first,
the tour.
You know? Who comes first?
So given a choice between acting or being on stage, Roger Daltrey still picking being on stage?
Well, I wouldn't do anything to jeopardize the Who ever being out there doing what they do best. Yeah. So that's my priority.
And what's the next performance schedule for the Who? So, because I know a lot of fans.
We're starting work in September doing charity shows and a few gigs around Europe and studio work. So that's going to be very interesting.
Oh,
very experimental.
You're going to do a new album?
We're going to try, but, I mean, whether we'll succeed is another thing.
Well, when you guys get trying on an album, I mean, sometimes it comes out, you know, there's two or three records in one or now discs, you know, so you don't do things on
a
small
level. It'll be exciting just to be back as a band. I mean, we worked last year all around the States, and it went incredibly well. And
yeah, I saw that show, yeah.
We toured Britain, and we're just feeling really positive about being together as a group again. We really feel like we used to in the old days.
Well, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for coming on with us, taking a couple minutes. We'll look for you on Witchblade on July.
Tell me a bit about playing for the concert for New York City.
Oh, it was just one of the most emotional nights of my life. But it was an honor to be there, and what an audience. That's all I can say. I mean, it was just one of those nights you never ever forget.
Yeah.
I mean, in that sense, it's more indelible on my mind than Woodstock even. Simply because of the audience reaction to us was a humbling experience to be on that stage in the first place. But the warmth that came from those people was just incredible, and I hope we gave them what they wanted, which was a good dose of hard edge rock and roll, and it seemed to lift them up. We tried to give them a good wake because we figured that their lives must have been hell for the previous 6 weeks, so the good thing about rock and roll music for me in my life is it's always managed to take me out of the worst kind of places, even albeit briefly. The music seems to transcend all the bad things in your life.
It works for me.
It works for me too.
And you guys are really came through on very on. What current artists bands are you listening to today?
I've got no particular favourites today. If I had to pick a favourite musician of all time, it would probably be I like the old Stax artists. I love all those people. But if it had to be one guy for his writing and the movement of his music over the years, although it's still, he's still stayed true to himself, it's probably Bob Dylan. But I love Brian Wilson. I saw his concert in London recently and it was just absolutely fantastic. And he played the whole of Pet Sounds, of which I went home and played immediately by the Beach Boys, and the record wasn't as good. So that's the measure of the humanity of the man, because he plays it live with such sensitivity that, wow, you just forget what a great songwriter he is. But I listen to public radio, so I listen to The Morning Becomes Eclectic, and I love that show. But they don't ever kind of promote the bands enough. You kind of really have to listen to find out who that was, and it kind of bugs me a bit because you've only got to have something go on in the car, and you miss the name of who the record was you was really digging. But I love that show.
And online they have, I don't know if you knew that, they print the whole playlist.
They do.
Online, so if you ever want, you can go online and find out what they played.
If you can remember it, yeah. The one you like, that's the trouble.
Okay. Many rock fans would include a Who record in their Desert Island Top 10.
Would they?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Oh, definitely.
That's surprising.
What records would you include? It can be Who, it could be anything.
God, my musical taste is so diverse. I don't know, I think if I took any music at all, it would frustrate the hell out of me that I didn't have all the rest. So I'd probably take nothing.
Peace and quiet, right?
Yeah, I think I'd have to say, yeah, because I think if I played something I really, really liked, it would remind me of something else I really, really liked, and if I didn't have that, it would frustrate the fuck out of me. So there you go.
There you have it.
I'll put up with silence.
What venues or countries do you enjoy playing?
Well, unfortunately, I love going to new territories. And when I do solo work, of which I just pick up any kind of singing job I can, because the voice, unlike a guitar, is not something that lasts forever. It wears out, and to keep it going, you have to use it. So, and the Who don't work enough for me as a singer. I think if I hadn't have done all the solo projects I've done during the Who's career, I don't think I would be the singer I am today, and be able to cut it for the Who, actually. So, for me, I love playing America. I mean, American crowds and American audiences and America generally has been so good to us. I love it. But it is exciting going to new territories for the first time, especially at the age we are. I did a solo show in Spain, and the Who have never played Spain, believe it or not. And I did that like 2 years ago, and I could not believe how fantastic the reaction was, because I was doing other people's songs and I played a few Who songs, and the reaction to the Who songs was incredible, and I thought, I cannot believe that the Who haven't played here, and it really frustrates me. But I'm hopeful that we can, in this pinnacle of our decline, play at least Japan and Australia and some of the South American countries and Spain before we finally stop, because it's not going to go on for much longer. There's no way we can do what we do for much longer now, because it demands so much energy. At the moment we can still do it and do it well, and if we couldn't do it well, I wouldn't be doing it, let alone Pete. I would be the one saying, no, don't want to do it, that's the end of it. But all the time we can do it well, I feel we should be out there playing our music, because our music is best played by us and no one else. So let's see. I think we've got a good 2 years of being able to do it well in our present state and with our present catalogue. If we come up with new material, which we're going to attempt, and if that reflects how we are now. Obviously, the time frame of the band's longevity could be stretched, because I would definitely... I mean, to give you a for instance, we're going to explore some of the catalogue that we haven't played on stage for a long time during this tour. We're going to play the hits that everybody wants to hear, of course, but we haven't played anything from the Who By Numbers for 20 years. And that's a great album. It's not the most commercial album, and it's not the most radio-friendly album, but there's some incredibly pertinent songs. Well, I haven't also listened to that album for probably 10 years. So I'm going to listen to that album and pretend that it's a completely new set of songs presented to me, and try and approach them not kind of doing a pastiche on what we did in 1975, but approach them as new songs, and approach them as, how do I feel about this song now? And let's see where that goes. That's going to be interesting.
Let me make sure we're still running here. Yeah, we are. How do you explain the longevity of the Who's music and their impact on crowds even today? I mean, you guys are still at the top of the game.
It's really a combination of two things. First and foremost, the songs, which really is down to the genius of Pete, that he wrote from such a personal inner perspective that was so honest that it becomes pertinent to all. So everyone can kind of identify it, where that comes from, and identify with those songs. And every generation that comes through adolescence, Pete was extremely good at writing about the angst and the bittersweet feelings of adolescence. So every generation that comes through that hears those songs and completely identifies with them, because the inner feelings of the person, of the human spirit, don't change. So first and foremost that. And second, we're quite a good band, and there's an incredible chemistry there. And like I said earlier, we can still deliver it, and we can still do it. There's something about those songs that demand a certain way of playing them. They demand incredible energy. They demand that you play them as though your life depends on them. When we can't do that anymore, it will be over.
All right, we'll buzz through these, I'm sorry. How do you prepare for higher energy shows, and how does it differ?
How do I prepare for what? So to speak up, I'm a bit deaf.
How do you prepare for your high energy shows, and how does it differ from the early days? If it does differ.
It doesn't differ, actually. I'm probably more lazy now than I used to be. But I suppose because I'm more relaxed about it, I seem to be able to pull it up more easily. But I do have to keep fit. I'm having a few physical problems in my shoulders at the moment. I had a car crash in Australia a couple of years ago, and that's given me a bit of trouble with my arms. But... I also look after my voice. I do warm up and warm down before every show, which most singers don't do. And it's a great mistake, because if you abuse your own voice, it will leave you one day, and probably sooner rather than later. I think people criticise me now, saying, oh, he can't quite hit the notes as he used to. Well, it's not surprising. I used to sing full voice high Ds. It doesn't matter that I can't hit those anymore. Most of those problems are created because we're still doing songs that were written 30 years ago. I think actually my voice today is a much better voice than it was in those days. It might not be able to get those really high notes, but there's a richness and an understanding and a kind of lived-in quality that it's gained over the years that I think makes it better. I would just like some new material to reflect that.
Which is actually one of the questions, is the new album in the works?
We are trying to make a new album. Who knows whether we'll be successful. We're going to go in the studio and see what comes out. If we're not happy with it, it won't ever be released until after we've got no say in the matter. which won't be long.
Future bonus tracks. What dynamics has Zach brought into the group?
Well, Zach was the missing link that we lacked when Keith died. We can never replace Keith's personality because he was just such a huge human being. I mean, he was a magnificent drummer and a magnificent showman, full of comedy and pathos, so many things. Moon was magical. But musically, Zach is every bit as good. And technically, he fills the space perfectly. And it is a very difficult space to fill because we're not like most bands. John is a lead guitarist on a bass. Pete is a rhythm lead guitarist on the guitar. And there's really, apart from the keyboard pad that played by Rabbit, John Rabbit Bundrick, who's been with us since 1979, there's not a lot in between, only the vocals. And the vocals drive the song. So the drumming part is critical. And it was such a shame that we made the mistake. And I felt really sorry for him. We got Kenny Jones to be our drummer, and Kenny is a fantastic drummer. He really is a great drummer, but his style just did not suit the band. And it just did not work. The chemistry dissolved. It wasn't right, and we were failing, and we were floundering like a stranded cod on a beach. But now with Zach back in the band, the energy's back, and it's magical when it happens.
Okay, there's only a couple more here. How did you come up with the stutter in the song My Generation? Well, it's definitely the key part of the song.
Well, it made it. It was a perfect way of reflecting that inarticulate anger that all adolescents have kind of welling up inside them, that they want to make their mark. Even if it's by writing their name on a wall, they want to make their mark. And a stutter seemed to be the simplest way of pulling that out. It really did embody all that frustration in one very simple statement.
Okay. And My Generation, the first two albums. What was it like being in the studio for the first time? Well, sort of.
That was a really fun album to make because we rehearsed the songs long before we recorded them. We knew what we were doing when we went in the studio. We literally almost did it like a live album. We did two or three takes of each song, and that was it. The whole album was recorded in two afternoons, and we were doing shows in the evening. And that's the way I love to work. I hope that when we record this time, I think if we spend more than, in my own opinion, this is my own opinion, if we spend more than 3 weeks in the studio, the album won't ever happen. I think where we need to spend our time is in a rehearsal studio and playing like a live band, because that's where the essence of Who music comes from. That's why Who's Next is such a great album. Quadrophenia would have been, I love Quadrophenia, it's a brilliant, brilliant album. It would have been an even better album had we played it on the road previously. They all lacked, Who by Numbers again, all those records, apart from Live at Leeds, of course, which was a live album, they all lacked that process of us having made the material completely ours, not just copying a Pete Townsend demo. They were organic to each one of us personally, and that really reflected in Who's Next and on the My Generation album.
Okay. And then this is actually our last question. What would you consider the highlight of your career? Highlights?
I don't consider any of it. I'm just so glad we had a career. There's been so many. I'd hate to pick one because there'd be another one I'd say, oh no, that should have been it. No, it's been wonderful, and I've got no complaints. I would make all the same mistakes again and do it all again exactly the same way, because it's, although the mistakes are painful, they do lead you on to another level, and you get through it, and you become better for them. So I've got no complaints whatsoever.
Okay, worth it. Thank you.
All right, mate. All the best to you.
Pete, how are you today?
I'm all right. I'm okay.
Happy birthday. It's around now, isn't it?
It was yesterday.
Oh, sorry.
It's Sunday, anyway.
Ta-da! Hey, Pete, this new album, Scooped?
Thank you.
Yes. I haven't heard it yet, but I remember the Secret Policeman's Ball, which was, I think, the first time I heard you doing acoustic versions of some of these songs.
Yeah, you know, this is not just acoustic stuff and demos and stuff. It's a whole wide range of stuff. I think I'm probably a bit sort of thinly spread musically, a bit of a dilettante in a way. But they call it eclectic, don't they? I like everything and I play everything. So these albums with the title Scoop are away from the mainstream, even for me as a solo artist. But, you know, that concert at Amnesty was the first time that I'd appeared in public playing solo acoustic, and I've obviously done it a lot since.
You know, some of the collaborations you've had, though, I love them. I loved John Lee Hooker on Iron Man, just with that voice coming in.
Yeah, he was such a hero of mine. I always feel that if I was around in the middle 40s, it would have been quite a surprise for me to know that both Hank Williams and John Lee Hooker were making, you know, rock and roll records. Long time for me to get that message, obviously, but their early recordings were, to me, the foundation of rock and roll. And it was a great thrill for me to have him on that record.
Well, the way you arranged it, just to have his voice coming in, was great. Another thing that I really admire, not to blow too much smoke, is the way that you've added so much variety to your life. You were writing children's books for a while, weren't you?
You know, I didn't write them. I published them. I had a publishing company called Eel Pie Books, and from 1977 through to 1981. And then after that, I sold that company and I went to work as an editor for Faber and Faber. So, you know, I was an art school kid when I was young, and I'm very interested in all of the arts, not just music. My passion and my skill is obviously in pop music, and that's where I'm safest. But I do like to dabble in the other things. And we started a children's book company, but we started to do books about rock and roll. We published particularly successful photo books, one about The Clash, another one about style in pop, you know, with Chalky Davis and Carol Starr for photography, and a book by Penny Smith, The Photographs of The Clash, actually sold 15,000 copies, which is kind of more than Cartier-Bresson sold in that year. So we were successful. The company grew too quickly, and it got out of my scope, really.
You can do another book?
I'm working on one now. I just finished it, yeah. Called The Boy Who Heard Music, and I'm kind of pleased with it. I put it down for a few weeks, and then I'll read it, and then I'll call you back and tell you if it's any good.
All right. Well, here's our number.
Hey, Pete, when you go back to these songs like Substitute or Eminence Front or Magic Bus especially, I mean, they're so identified with The Who. Do you have a different relationship to these songs going back since you wrote them?
Yeah, definitely. You know, in this case, on the CD, the Eminence Front version is one that actually happened after The Who recorded it. I did a rehearsal for a show I did for Paul Simon, and I recorded it at home. And it had a completely different feel. I used a little kind of drum box thing, and Magic Bus, of course, is the original demo, which I did way, way, way back in 1964 on a home studio. And Substitute, again, was something that I did at home. In each case, these are included because they are radically different from the way that The Who recorded them, and radically different not so much in intention, because they were all intended as Who songs, but in interpretation. It's not to say that I think that they're better or comparable or otherwise. It's just the way that I perform them, and The Who's a very powerful machine. You know, when I pick up an electric guitar and play with the other guys in the band, you know, I become a different person. I feel different, and so when I'm working alone, I think I feel more balanced and less stratified, less strapped up, less, you know, less focused in a way. I'm freer.
You know, I've seen interviews with you where you've actually been critical of some of the later work of The Who, but what I'm wondering is, when you do an album like this, are you doing this because it really interests you and then just hope that the audience goes along with it, or are you, like, objective enough to say, wow, this would be very entertaining for other people, or is that too crazy a question?
No, it's not crazy. You know, what it's about is trying to create a chronology, a body of work. It's trying to link everything up and trying to make sense of the fact that the Who, you know, and it was me that broke the band up. You know, I got a few messages about my hearing in the late 70s, and I decided to stop touring and recording with the Who in 82, and we've had 18, 19 years with no recorded product, and so mm-hmm. a lot of people only know the Who as somebody that has come out of the dust of the past and appeared today. Here we are. So a lot of the stuff that I've been doing on my website, a lot mm-hmm. of the stuff that I do with Scoop these days is to try to reconnect, give people a sense of the continuity and the chronology, if not of the Who as a working band, certainly for me as a composer. And I think that these, particularly the compilation, which is available in stores, which is called Scooped, which is available on Redline, I think that gives you a sense of what I've been doing for that whole period
right.
of time.
What about Zach Starkey, Ringo's son? How does he fit into your life personally?
You know, as a friend, I've known him since he was a kid. He was brought into the orbit of the Who by Keith Moon, who was a friend of Ringo's. You know, they were drinking buddies.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think Keith was more of an influence on the young Zach as a drummer than Ringo. But, you know, the band that we have now, with John Rabbit Bundrick on keyboards and Hammond and the three guys in the Who and Zach, it's hard to beat it. You know, Zach is an extraordinary drummer in his own right. He can do some of the things that Keith Moon did, and he was a fan of Keith, but he's also very, very energetic and fluid in his own right. You know, we're still finding... I'm looking forward to studio work and writing work with these guys. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens, because I think people might think that what we would do with Zach is what we used to do with Keith, that we will reproduce that old sound. But I think Zach is a completely different drummer in so many ways. You know, he can do what Keith did, but he's also his own man. So it's all very exciting.
Now, if this new material fits your criteria, you'll release it, and if not, you won't? Is that how it goes?
No. I don't want to waste time recording if we're not going to put it out. I
mm-hmm.
think what I want to do is spend some time writing and creating and jamming and seeing what we come up with. If we decide to record, we'll put it out. it's like a performance, isn't it? You know, you go on and you do it. So, for example, you know, the Who's next album, which mm-hmm. was a great sounding record, was recorded in 8 days, but the creative period prior to that was nearly 2 years.
Wow.
So the actual recording, going in with the band and making the record, is something that we will do very quickly. And if we go in to make a record, we will put it out.
Can I just say, Pete, I saw Tommy, and I've seen it a couple of times now, and to me it was just a remarkable theater experience. I try to tell people who don't normally go to the theater, I say, this isn't one of your normal musicals. This thing is about a lot of things, and one of the things that I got from it is post-traumatic stress. I don't know whether you intended that, but the way they staged it was just remarkable.
That's right. I mean, there was a lot of that stuff that came into it, wasn't there, about the dilemmas involved in bringing up a family in the modern world, the stresses and strains of a post-war scenario, and of course now we have, you know, a huge terrorism that we're facing today, and the way that affects people. You know, where I think the story of Tommy was about a boy who grew up, you know, in a post-war scenario, post-war, you know, unable to sleep at night, disturbed by a family that was damaged by war. And I think, you know, if we look at the events of the recent past, we know that okay, a lot of us have been hardened and tempered, and there's growth there for us, but a lot of people are really damaged by that kind of thing, and sometimes you don't see the damage until years and years later, and Tommy was about that. Tommy was about, to some extent, if it's not making something so, you know, basic, a rock opera, into something which it's not. It was about to the effects of growing up. Maybe it was about why rock and roll happened, because I don't know that British rock and roll, as I understand it anyway, would have happened if it had not been for the war years.
You've got to be proud of the way that the songs that you've written have stood the test of time. My God, could you have seen that?
Well, it's what I hoped. I think a lot of it's really about the, you know, to simplify, and this is not to demean myself, but, you know, we're a very strong demographic group. You know, we boomers, and the music that we grew up with stays with us, and that applies to all of the artists from the mid-60s.
But pop is so spontaneous, and rock and roll comes out of so much energy and emotion. Some music that came out when you started recording has sort of a very dated sound to it, and, you know, people must have loved it then, but it just doesn't hold up. But the stuff that you wrote is deeper and it has more layers to find in it.
Well, it's nice of you to say so. I mean, I went through two phases in my life. When I started, I looked at my audience. I shouldn't call it my audience. I looked at the Who's audience. But at that time when I started, were young. Sometimes they were immigrant. They were certainly working class. And I looked at their situation, and I realized that what was going on for a lot of them was that there was some spiritual dilemma. They weren't victims of poverty or drug abuse or a post-war syndrome or whatever. There was just some spiritual malaise going on. It was almost as though they had no reason, you know, no reason to live, but they were alive. And music and fashion and all of that stuff seemed to be what they lived for. And I just reflected that for many years, you know, up until when I started to work on Tommy, I started to really tackle the whole spiritual question head on. And I think it was there that I had actually started to really deal with complicated stuff. And when you get to that place, you know, sometimes you succeed and sometimes you fail miserably. From then on, you know, the pendulum swings were much greater. And that's really where I still am today. I'm most interested in writing about how rock music, how art functions with the audience to express some spiritual condition, to reflect some spiritual condition. The book that I've just written, I think, is entirely about that.
Generation. The classic rock station, The Who's My Generation. That song has pretty much the most memorable bass guitar solo of any major rock song out there in rock history. And speaking of legendary, we have got one of rock's greatest bass guitarists on the phone with us right now, Mr. John Entwistle of The Who.
John.
Hello.
Mr. Ox, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks.
Thank you for being here with us. We appreciate you doing this. Just had a look at the John Entwistle website, and those that are fans of, you know, one of the world's greatest rock bassists probably should go take a look at this thing. It's really nice.
We try and update it as much as we can, but
JohnEntwistle.com.
Kind of difficult.
No, you guys have done a nice job. I mean, believe me, there are far worse updated sites out there than your site.
Yeah. We try and keep, like, sort of 2 years behind. Yeah,
yeah, that's not. That's good. That's about average. That's good. So, John, why don't you, first of all, let's just kind of talk a little bit about where you're at right now.
Yeah, we're kind of back to a five-piece again. It means that every show is different, so it's much better than having a large band where every show is exactly the same.
What's it been like, and how long has this process been going on?
It was a gradual process. I think it kind of culminated in the Quadrophenia show, which was kind of very regimented because we were working to film all the time, and we had like a 14-piece band.
Which was an incredible show. Saw the Portland show. You guys did a beautiful job.
Yeah, well, we actually got to the stage where we thought, well, I wonder if we could actually go back to being a four or five-piece. Yeah. And we tried a concert. I can't remember where it was. But we tried a concert that just the five of us, and it worked great. And we decided to keep it at that. And this much more adventurous, you know, we get to jam a lot more, which the fans obviously like because it makes every show different.
And if you just joined us, we've got John Entwistle on the line here, the bass guitarist for The Who. Speaking of jamming, John, here's a little something that you guys jammed on at the 9/11 tribute. It's The Classic Rock Station with John Entwistle of The Who. That, of course, is one of the great songs off of It's Hard. That album came out 20 years ago this year. Pretty amazing that we're coming to that anniversary. That song, of course, is called Eminence Front. John, you, there's one thing, you know, as we talk about sort of the band coming back together, being more active, I think you're widely credited with writing the highlight on the last studio album. Dangerous. I mean, is there any question that I thought Dangerous was way better than Eminence Front, which is widely cited as one of the better songs. But I mean, Dangerous kicked everything's butt. I guess what I'm trying to say is, has Pete Townsend been letting you contribute anything to the new project that you guys are working on?
Not yet. I mean, I've got plenty of ideas for songs. But it's kind of weird because Dangerous was originally about an underage girl. And our producer at that time, Glyn John, said it's a little bit frivolous for The Who. So I had to change the words to Dangerous being like sort of muggers and nasty people. So I was kind of disappointed in Dangerous in from some respects, yeah. But I'm working on a few songs now. I haven't actually put them down yet, but there'll be two or three, I hope.
Well, hold that thought, John. We're going to talk more about the album and the tour in just a moment. First, I want to play one of the better songs off of It's Hard. John Entwistle wrote this. This is Dangerous. It's The Who. John Entwistle wrote it. He's with us now on the Classic Rock Station. He's hanging with us. He just told us that he didn't like that version of the song. Hard to believe. Well, that, of course, was from the last Who studio album. We're going to find out next, if John can hang on with us, we're going to find out if there is a chance for a new Who studio album 20 years later. Hang tight, it's the Classic Rock Station.
See me, feel me, touch me, heal me.
The songwriting process with you and Pete and Roger, and sort of how are things going, and is there any progress being made, and are you guys happy so far with what's happening?
It's a strange thing about that. We never tell each other. We never tell each other what songs we've written until it's time to use them. You know? I think Pete has written quite a few. Roger's written a couple. I'm just starting to like put my ideas together. I've only just organised my demo studio upstairs in the house. So, I have loads of words, loads of melodies. All I have to do is like stick them together with glue. But it's we usually present demos or the sort of rough idea. About the only album that we ever rehearsed the songs before we went in the studio was Who's Next. But hopefully we'll get to hear the songs long before we get to record them, because the last few albums we just got in the studio, heard the songs, put them down, and gone home.
Well, it isn't like you guys are sterile in the studio.
We never seem to be able to record in the studio with the same energy as we produce on stage. You know. Kind of a weird thing.
But you live and you learn. And I mean, it's been 20 years now, and I know the fans are certainly eager that something will come out of this.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, but I'm not so concerned about the new album as carrying on playing. You know, I know that will lead to a good album.
And speaking of which, tell us how that playing is going, because no one has heard it since you guys reconvened in Los Angeles to start to rehearse the tour. And what are your feelings so far, and how are things going?
Oh, they're going great. We did a short English tour a while ago, and that was a lot of fun. We did some warm up gigs leading up to that Albert Hall gig. And it's great. It's we're playing better and better together. You know, we can hear what each other's playing, and we sort of fire ideas backwards and forwards on stage. And it's kind of like the old days. You know? A lot of jamming, improvisation. You know, I don't enjoy playing the same bass part twice, so it's good when you've got a five or six piece band up there, and you can like communicate with each other on stage, change things around.
Wow. I'm talking to John Entwistle right now. I am Fendrick. It's the Classic Rock Station. Let's play some more Who, John. Hanging out with Mr. John Entwistle of The Who today. Our pleasure to have him on board. They're gearing up for a great big tour, and that's a great big song from The Who right there. What sort of a roadmap for a set list did you guys put together when you decided to do the tour? Was it mostly, you knew that you had to do some crowd pleasers, but were there some things that you were throwing in there that you thought, oh, it's been a long time since we did that?
Well, we usually try different songs at rehearsal, and if they work, they work. I mean, we did Baby Don't You Do It on this English part of the tour, which is kind of weird. You know, we forgot how to play it, kind of.
Sure.
We try and bring in old songs that people haven't heard for a while. And if they work, we keep them in, and if they don't, we throw them out. But I mean, I know when I go to concerts, I want to hear the stuff that I know.
And unfortunately for you guys, there's a lot of songs people know, which brings us to this new CD collection. MCA Universal is putting this out. It's a greatest hits collection. It's called The Who Ultimate Collection. We will be given a million of these CDs away on the air here. You didn't have time to be involved with this greatest hits collection, did you?
I don't even know what it is.
That is so rock star. You don't even know you have a new album coming out. You're a very busy man. You've got your artwork that you're selling on the internet. By the way, we will be giving away one of your autographed self-portraits here on the Classic Rock Station. So when you're not playing with the Entwistle Band, you're not playing with The Who, what does John Entwistle do just to kind of unwind and relax?
I've spent quite a lot of time in Mexico. I've got a few timeshares over there, so I go fishing three times a year. So most of the time, like at least a month, is spent in Cabo in Mexico.
Beautiful town. And do you wear a sombrero when you're there?
No, but I do tend to walk around without a jacket.
I would imagine you would stand out there.
Well, most of the time, I basically look like a Hawaiian tourist when I'm walking down there, so I don't get recognized that much.
That's a great image of you at Cabo. That is fantastic.
Yeah, in shorts, you know.
Well, listen, we're very excited to, we're really looking forward to seeing you out on stage with The Who again.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, too.
We want to thank you for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. John Entwistle of The Who here on the Classic Rock Station. We'll rock again for you in just moments.